I'm Jim Kushner, in case some of you don't know me. I'm one of the founders and former executive director of the fellowship and editor of Touchdown. I'm here to introduce our first speaker, Hans Boersma. As editor of Touchdown, I would receive many review copies of books over the years, and I couldn't read them all, and they would pile up. But I always noted what looked really interesting. And some I would kind of put to the side, and I go, I got to read that. And I received some copies of Heavenly Participation by Hans Boersma, and boy, that was so intriguing to me. And so I had to put that aside to read, and subsequent books. So Hans really stood out to me. I have to confess that, as with 99.9% of the books that I've intended to read, including ones that I've bought for myself, I still haven't read them yet. But I know I will be disappointed if I leave this earth and I've not read Hans Boersma's Heavenly Participation. I told myself last year that I must read it, so you can tell me that too if you want to remind me. I was reading recently Paul Tyson, as an Australian philosopher, his book, excellent book called A Christian Theology of Science. And while I'm reading it, he mentions the best theological minds of this century. And he mentions Alistair MacIntyre and other theologians. I can't remember now, but I look and there's Hans Boersma. And I agree. You're in for a treat to listen to his words and then read them in the magazine once they're published as well. He is currently teaching at Neshota House up in Wisconsin, holding the St. Benedict Servants of Christ chair in ascetical theology. And he's working on a book on the traditional practice of Lectio Divina, reading scripture every day, which is dear to my heart. And the book is entitled Pierced by Love, Divine Reading with the Christian Tradition. He's also written Five Things Theologians Wish Biblical Scholars Knew. Seeing God and, as I mentioned, Heavenly Participation. His main theological interest is the retrieval of the sacramental ontology of the great tradition of the church. He's an ordained priest within the Anglican Church in North America. He's a senior editor of Touchstone. We're also glad to announce that as well just in the past year. He's joined. He's here with his wife, Linda. They split their time between Wisconsin and Vancouver, Canada. And I know they have, was it five children? And 10, 14 grandchildren? Yes, wonderful. So that tells you a lot that you need to know about him. So Father Hans, please.
Thank you so much, Jim, for those kind words of introduction. Paul Tyson is, well, most of the things he says are true. Not everything he says is true. but his book, Returning to Reality, is an amazing book. And his new book on science is also very, very good, I think. But Returning to Reality is a book that you want to pick up. Hierarchy is in trouble. I am not telling you anything new. We all know that our society is strictly egalitarian. A view of reality that is patterned vertically with higher and lower places on the chain of being generally gets dismissed rather quickly. We tend to associate hierarchy with medieval feudalism, obscurantism, unfairness, and especially oppressive power and violence. As moderns, we celebrate the equal opportunity that a non-stratified egalitarian society offers. and we take courage from the horizontalizing or flattening of its horizons, for it treats everyone as equals and hence offers protection against arbitrary power from above. Or so we think. In short, modernity associates hierarchy with imposition of power and aims to eradicate this evil by replacing hierarchy with equality, and vertical stratification with horizontal relationality. In this talk, I want to investigate the principles that undergird a hierarchical metaphysic. I'll do so by turning to the 6th century Syrian monk Dionysius, in part because he was the first to use the term hierarchy and wrote extensively about its relation to power, and in part because Dionysius thought deeply about hierarchy, both in terms of the structures of reality in general and in terms of ecclesial structures. I hope to show that the Dionysian hierarchy, which undergirded church and society in the Middle Ages, did indeed have the functioning of power at its center, but not the kind of power that violently imposes itself upon the disenfranchised and marginalized, but the kind that lovingly lifts others into the very heart of God. I will also try to turn the tables on modernity by briefly comparing the implications of an egalitarian, nominalist metaphysic with those of a hierarchical, participatory metaphysic. My basic argument is that when power is embedded within a hierarchical, participatory metaphysic, it serves to uplift others, to hierarchize them into God himself. By contrast, the modern atomizing and mapping of creaturely beings onto a strictly horizontal map of creaturely beings requires centralized power structures to manage and control individual beings. Put differently, within a hierarchical view of reality, power serves to lift up rather than to oppress. Whereas within an egalitarian view of reality, power naturally oppresses people rather than lift them up. Before turning to Dionysius, I briefly want to turn to Shakespeare, his Macbeth, for it too teaches us a great deal about power. Macbeth, after all, is motivated primarily by power. Told by 3 witches that he will be king one day, and incited by his wife, Macbeth takes steps to make the prophecy come true. Rejecting the sacred obligations he has to his kinsman and lord, King Duncan of Scotland, he decides to murder him. A shocking act of rebellion against the social structure of society and, of course, against life itself. This first murder leads to numerous others. First, of the 2 chamberlains whom Macbeth and his wife have framed as the alleged murderers of the king. Then also of Banquo, whose son threatens to become a potential challenger to the throne. And finally, of the wife and children of his antagonist, Macduff. The power that Macbeth pursues is hardly power as power is meant to be. King Duncan's son Malcolm reflects on the nature of power in the play's final act when he reflects on his own alleged shortcomings in conversation with Macduff. Malcolm shares with Macduff the characteristics of the graces of a good king. The king becoming graces as justice, verity, temperance, stableness, bounty, perseverance, mercy, lowliness, devotion, patience, courage, fortitude. I have no relish of them, but abound in the division of each several crime, acting in many ways. Nay, had I power, I should pour the sweet milk of concord into hell, uproar the universal peace, confound all unity on earth. Malcolm seems quite despairing of himself, but the audience knows that contrary to his words, he is actually a fitting heir to his father's throne. Regardless of his own suitability to exercise power, Malcolm is right to think the proper handling of power requires outstanding virtues. For in their absence, the king might pour the sweet milk of concord into hell. Hell, of course, is what Macbeth creates, both around himself and in himself. As Macduff puts it, not in the legions of horrid hell can come a devil more damned in evils to top Macbeth. As he pursues tyrannous power based in bloodshed, Macbeth ends up with mental torture. Oh, full of scorpions is my mind, dear wife. Tormented by guilt, he can no longer hold it together. I am in blood, stepped in so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er. First he, then also Lady Macbeth, begin to experience hallucinations as they lose their grip upon reality. Here is Macbeth, first losing a sense of reality. Is this a dagger which I see before me? The handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, and yet I see thee still. Art thou not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? Or art thou but a dagger of the mind, a false creation proceeding from the heat-oppressed brain? Well, initially, the idea of murdering his king seems fantastical to Macbeth. Once the wicked deed is done, he turns back to the demonic witches who anticipate his coming with the chant, "By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes." The theme of our conference. The wicked tyrant consults the three witches, only to be tricked by them about his own future. As we know, the tragedy ends with Lady Macbeth committing suicide and Macbeth himself being killed by Macduff, the nobleman who helps King Duncan's son Malcolm to regain the Scottish throne. Macbeth's use of power makes him lose touch with reality, for it is tyrannous power, not grounded in reality. His oppressive behavior pulls him as well as his country down into the abyss of hell. Indeed, as the porter of Macbeth's Inverness Castle recognizes, the castle has turned into a hellish place. Knock, knock, knock. Who's there? In the name of Beelzebub. Knock, knock. Who's there? In the other devil's name. By contrast, it is virtuous kings, Duncan, his son Malcolm, whose power uplifts them and the people of Scotland that they serve. Tyrant Macbeth does not spare one thought to his Scottish people. By contrast, Macduff's groan, "Oh, Scotland, Scotland," tells us both where his heart is and what power is meant to do. O nation miserable, with an untitled tyrant bloody sceptered, when shalt thou see thy wholesome days again? The difference between the two mindsets could hardly be more obvious. The one exploits power to put down, to oppress, thus lapsing into demonic and hallucinatory fantasies of hell. The other uses power to lift up, to hierarchize, thus guiding his subjects to the harmonious peace of unity on earth. Let's turn from Shakespeare to Dionysius, who through much of the Christian tradition was identified with Dionysius the Areopagite, mentioned in Acts 17 as being converted through Paul's sermon on Mars Hill. He articulates his theology mainly in four books: the divine names, the mystical theology, and then the heavenly hierarchy and the ecclesiastical hierarchy. The first two are in some ways markedly different from the last two. As the titles intimate, the divine names and the mystical theology discuss the question of how it is that we can name God, considering his transcendence. While the celestial hierarchy and the ecclesiastical hierarchy deal with the divinely ordered structures of angels and of the church. Still, the books are all closely linked. To understand how Dionysius viewed power, we need to look at his discussion of angelic and ecclesiastical hierarchies against the backdrop of the participatory metaphysic that he outlines in the divine names and the mystical theology. Now, before we ask after the role of power in Dionysius' hierarchies, we should investigate what he meant by hierarchy. He defines it in chapter 3 of the Celestial Hierarchy as a sacred order and knowledge and operation assimilated as far as attainable to the likeness of God and lifted up, anagogein is the verb, lifted up to the illuminations granted to it from God according to capacity, with a view to divine imitation. A little further in the same chapter, he ventures a second attempt at defining the term. He then, he says, who mentions hierarchy, denotes a certain altogether sacred arrangement. So sacred order in the first one, sacred arrangement here. An image of the supremely divine blossoming, ministering the mysteries of its own illumination in hierarchical ranks and understandings. So hierarchy is a sacred order or arrangement. The order contains members with varying degrees of dissimilarity from God. And these members of the hierarchy are meant to be lifted up, and again, lifted up, each in accordance with a mode of its own being, according to its own capacity. Analogy is the term that he uses, its own capacity, toward the simple beauty or goodness of God. In the process, more and more being assimilated to God, whose perfection implies that he has no unlikeness at all. Dionysius then repeatedly uses this language of being lifted up, or as he also calls it, being hierarchized. It's crucial to observe that to hierarchize does not mean to control or rule in tyrannous fashion. Dionysius would abhor the actions of Macbeth. To be sure, hierarchies and hierarchizing have everything to do with order and ranks. But when a hierarchy hierarchizes, this simply means that in line with their created distinctiveness, the various beings are lifted up so as to become more like God. This means that the role of the various hierarchies is mystagogical. Dionysius writes his book, The Ecclesiastical Hierarchy, for, he says, for those who have been initiated with the initiation of the sacred mystagogy derived from the hierarchical mysteries. Now, the role of a mystagogue is to initiate others into certain religious mysteries. For example, in the centuries preceding Dionysius, mystagogical catechesis served to explain to newly baptized Christians the meaning of the mysteries enacted in the liturgy. Dionysius puts it this way: let us view our hierarchy conformably to ourselves, abounding in the variety of sensible symbols by which, in proportion to our capacity, we are conducted hierarchically according to our measure to the uniform deification, God and divine virtue. So the aim of every hierarchy is for the members to be lifted up into God, deification. Dionysius's view of power is reflected, it seems to me, in Malcolm's description of true kingship. King becoming graces, as justice, verity, temperance, stableness, bounty, perseverance, mercy, lowliness, devotion, patience, courage, fortitude. Indeed, on a Dionysian hierarchical understanding, power serves only one purpose: to facilitate the mystagogical return of creatures to God, from whom they have come by way of procession. Power serves not to put down or oppress. It serves the process of returning to God. A telling section of the fifth chapter of the ecclesiastical hierarchy discusses the power, as he calls it, dunamis, the power of the sacraments, the ministers, and the initiates. For sacraments, sacraments themselves have three powers again: purification of uninitiated, illumination of those who are being purified, and then perfection of those instructed. Ministers, secondly, after the sacraments, ministers too have three powers: purification of the uninitiated through the sacraments, illumination of those purified, and again, perfection of their understanding. And finally, the initiates themselves have three powers: the power of being purified, of being illuminated, and of perfecting the understanding. In short, power is the ability to guide or to be guided through the process of purification, illumination, and perfection. True, Dionysius' hierarchies offer a dazzling outline of heavenly and ecclesiastical structures. Angels are divided into three hierarchical groupings of three, as you can see in diagram number one that you've received: seraphim, cherubim, and thrones, dominions, powers, and authorities, and finally, principalities, archangels, and angels. The church, too, is structured by way of hierarch, priest, and deacon, monks, laity, and uninitiated, and within that last group, catechumens, penitents, demon-possessed. To a modern mindset, what is perhaps most troubling about this structure is its seemingly static character. We insist on equal opportunity. We want a chance to advance. Dionysius' categories seem static. They do not allow for this kind of upward mobility. This criticism is partly on target. Once an archangel, always an archangel. Archangels do not become seraphim. The heavenly hierarchy does not change. On the other hand, within the ecclesial hierarchy, some degree of movement is possible. Deacons can become priests and hierarchs. Catechumens even have the intention of advancing to the rank of laity. And some of them may end up becoming deacons or priests. Some mostly limited upward mobility is possible, at least within the ecclesial hierarchy. Dionysius, however, does not even discuss such upward mobility. To give but one example, for Dionysius, if I'm a priest, my aim is not to become a bishop. That aim might, for a variety of reasons, be a terrifying prospect. The role of a priest for Dionysius is to prepare catechumens for the celebration of the Eucharist, to give them a proper understanding of it, so they may properly contemplate what they are about to celebrate. Now, for Dionysius, it was not enough to speak of God in terms of being. Influenced as he was by the Neoplatonic philosophers Plotinus and Proclus, Dionysius foregrounded negative or apophatic language about God. Time and again, the Areopagite speaks of God as beyond being, hyperousios. He freely uses terms such as the one, goodness, and beauty to refer to this God beyond being. But even these exalted terms, which reach beyond the realm of being, do not adequately capture who God is. We use these names not because we thereby capture God. Rather, we speak of God as one to indicate that in a unique manner, he is all things, the cause of all things, without losing his oneness. And we speak of him as goodness and beauty to make clear that he is the cause of every good and beautiful thing. This, writes Dionysius, the one good and beautiful is uniquely cause of all the many things beautiful and good. But because God is actually beyond any of these concepts, we have to negate even the concept of one, goodness and beauty, or rather move beyond them. The hidden God is beyond oneness, at least the way we commonly understand oneness. Similarly, he is beyond good, hyper agathon, beyond good. He's beyond beauty and so on. It should be obvious that for Dionysius, the language of being or esse will not do to describe God. The philosophical tradition, beginning already with Parmenides, taught Dionysius that being implies intelligibility. To say God is being would mean for Dionysius that our concepts can encapsulate God. Such a God, on his understanding at least, could not possibly be transcendent. Dionysius therefore relegates being to a lower realm, that of intellect, which is a step down from the utterly unknowable and ineffable deity. For Dionysius, when we move into the darkness beyond intellect, we end up with complete speechlessness and unknowing. Nothing positive can be said about the beyond being cause of all things. We must negate even our negative statements about God. Because he is beyond being, creatures cannot participate in him. Creatures participate in the being of God, but not in God as beyond being. The upshot is that for Dionysius, God is radically transcendent. And with respect to God as hyperousios, we simply do not participate in him. This unprecedented emphasis on God's transcendence means he cannot possibly be part of any hierarchy. He does not even occupy a place at the very top. Hierarchies have to do with being, whereas the Dionysian God beyond being transcends all of this. Let me illustrate the importance of this claim by depicting two possible approaches to hierarchy and participation. Diagram 2 that you have there treats God as the highest level of a hierarchy. Now, this does two things. First, it turns God into one being among many beings. After all, here God is depicted as one item among many. The others may be much lower than he is, but no matter where they're located, they, together with God, are so many links within the one chain of being. Dionysius emphatically rejects the notion that God would be a being, one among many, for it would mean that within the chain of being, God and his creatures compete, as it were, for space. It would mean that whenever God exercises power in a certain activity, he exercises this power instead of creatures. And of course, the obverse would be true as well. when creatures exercise their power in a certain activity, they thereby foreclose the exercise of divine power. In other words, God's relationship with creatures would be a zero-sum game. What God does, other beings cannot do. What they do, God cannot do. Such competition would endanger the radical otherness or transcendence of God. And Dionysius avoids this by treating God and creatures in a non-competitive relationship. A non-competitive relationship gives genuine power to creatures. Human beings can cooperate with God in the process of lifting up or hierarchizing. As God enlightens creatures, each in its own way imitates God according to its creaturely capacity or analogy. God's activity, his energy in Greek, his activity is at work in them so that God does what they do. They do what God does. The creature becomes, as St. Paul would put it, God's fellow worker. Synergos. The essence of hierarchy, explains Eric Pearl, is the sacramental principle of cooperation, of synergy. This means not merely that the creature and God work together as though the creature were another being additional to God, or that the creature's operation is merely by courtesy attributed to God, but what it means is that the activity of the creature by participation truly is that of God. For Dionysius, synergy is possible because God is both transcendent and immanent. At the same time, he's not one item within the hierarchy. Treating God as one item within the hierarchy, at the very top, to be sure, has an additional adverse effect. God would be present only to the level immediately below him. Now, perhaps we might think here of the seraphim, cherubim, and thrones, God's highest creatures. They might directly participate in God, since they would be located immediately below him. But human beings would not, nor would elephants, let alone oak trees or rocks. On a Dionysian understanding, no matter where a creature is located within the overall hierarchical scheme, no matter the generous mediation offered by higher to lower levels, say a priest to a catechumen, creatures nonetheless always directly participate in God, while God is directly present to them. We may perhaps picture the relationship as it is depicted in the third diagram, God beyond hierarchy. We see here that God is utterly transcendent. He is not part of the hierarchy, but transcends it. He is not one being among many. That is why the diagram places God beyond the hierarchical triangle. To be sure, God's transcendence implies sovereignty. God is above creatures. Scripture often uses hierarchical terminology to speak about God employing metaphors such as king or father. Hence, also in a Dionysian hierarchy, God is higher than creatures. After all, Dionysius speaks of God's power lifting up, hierarchizing creatures. Anagogical discourse, language that is of ascending to God, intimates God is higher than creatures. But such vertical discourse, along with hierarchical metaphors, does not adequately capture or comprehend God. While creatures are bounded or limited, indicated by the rectangular boxes, God is unbounded or infinite, something no diagram can adequately depict. God is not part of the created hierarchy. Because he is not circumscribed in any way, not a being present within the created hierarchy, God is omnipresent. He is present to every creature, and every creature participates in him, which the diagram depicts with a circle that surrounds each creature. Each creature within the hierarchy participates in the being of God. Though the different shades of green indicate varying degrees of participation, the God beyond being is not only radically transcendent, but God is also, precisely because of his transcendence, immanent to the entire created order, every level of the hierarchy. Eric Pearl puts it this way: the one immediately produces and is present to the entire sequence of hierarchical mediation. As the productive power of the whole, the one is present throughout the whole. For Dionysius, divine transcendence and immanence are in no way opposed to each other. The reason he manages to combine transcendence and immanence is that he does not treat God as one of many beings. God himself is beyond being, hyperousios, so that he does not in any way need to either crowd out or make room for the beings that proceed from him. Pearl writes, God is not a being, the first link in the great chain standing at the summit of the cosmic hierarchy. If he were, he would be a determinate being, a member of the cosmos, one existing thing among other existing things. Rather, as the determinate being of all things, himself beyond being, God is at once transcendent and immanent, beyond the entire hierarchy of creatures and permeating the whole from top to bottom. God, according to Dionysius, permeates the whole without being any one of its constituent elements. The world is hierarchically structured, inescapably so. Modernity has lost its faith in hierarchy because it has lost the notion of participation. As a result, we insist on strictly egalitarian social arrangements. It is not, however, like we no longer have any hierarchies. It is just that ours are socially constructed and are strictly functional. My dean still tells me when to teach a course. Army captains still issue military orders to their lieutenants. And to give also a more revolting example, health officers still demand vaccinations as a prerequisite for participation in public life. All of these, however, are functional rather than ontological hierarchies. They are the result of various social contracts rather than being grounded in the nature of things. We need these social contracts because life together would be impossible without power or hierarchy of some kind. Power in modernity is the result of the way in which we construct relationships. In other words, the modern social web, including its power relations, is grounded in a nominalist, which is to say constructivist, understanding of reality, rather than in a realist, participatory metaphysic. Let me turn your attention to the final diagram, which approximates the way moderns view power, whether in church or more broadly in society. The face of power in modern settings purports to be much gentler than that of ancient and medieval societies. Earlier societies, so we tend to think, were brutal in their exercise of power, whereas in our enlightened world, we recognize the equality of all, so that we give power to people or institutions by assigning particular functions to them. The reality, however, is much different. The structure in this final diagram is a strictly this worldly one. The top circle is Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates or Justin Trudeau, come from Canada, unfortunately. But the top circle is one of those, not God. We have at best bracketed God and removed him from the picture. We no longer need God for power to function well, or so we think. In other words, we have a thoroughly non-participatory, nominalist universe, which for its functioning depends upon the way we structure our power relationships. The result is a voluntarist arrangement. Voluntarism being a word derived from the Latin voluntas, will. The Hobbesian and Lockean social contract depends upon the human will, which purportedly has agreed to yield certain powers to those in control. But the increasing power of companies, as we heard last night already, companies such as Google, Facebook, and Twitter, makes more and more evident that large masses of people are virtually powerless in the face of powers that impose, exclude, and silence at will. It is often the voluntas of one or a few individuals at the top that predetermines the outcome of our social debates. Perhaps we already live in Inverness Castle. The powers question should be ours too. Knock, knock, knock. Who's there in the name of Beelzebub? Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor at the time of the Reformation, would have been green with envy at the power at Bill Gates' disposal. The reason for the emperor's impotence should be obvious. Charles V functioned within a hierarchical feudal system with mediating powers such as monarchs, nobles, knights, peasants, and a variety of often pesky ecclesial figures, monks, priests, bishops, popes. These mediating and overlapping powers stood in the way of any emperor who would attempt arbitrarily or unilaterally to impose his will. Voluntarism, as depicted in the last diagram, knows no mediating powers. And where they do continue to exist, they've largely been robbed of genuine influence. An egalitarian society is one that, in principle, has opened itself up to totalitarian rule, something that today only those willfully blind are still not able to see. With sainted King Duncan gone, Macbeth turns power into tyranny. Something wicked this way comes. But the most important difference between power in a traditional hierarchical system and power in egalitarian societies does not concern where power is situated, whether throughout the hierarchies, including their mediating people and institutions, or only at the top, particularly among global elites, though that is an important difference. But the greatest difference has to do with what we understand power to be. Egalitarians construe power as a means of control. Power is a functional thing, after all. It is something we give to people who we think will get the job done. The result is we link power with control, whether subtle or harsh. For Dionysius and for the Christian tradition in his wake, power is an ontological thing. It is something rooted in the nature of reality. As a result, for Dionysius, power is mystagogical in character, facilitating the return of created beings into God himself. Modern egalitarians use power to oppress and put down. Dionysian mystics use it to hierarchize, to lift up. True, I know. Also within traditional hierarchies, power has been misused. While modern egalitarian structures witness shining examples of selfless service. True. How come? Most sinful behavior negatively affects even the best structures. While the image of God continues to shine, no matter how confused and messed up our structures become. Counterexamples are hardly surprising. But that nonetheless, Christian hierarchies lift us up to heaven, while modern hierarchies bring us down to hell, is nothing new to those who have read and have compared the founding documents of the Christian and the modern liberal traditions. Thank you. I think we have time for a few questions. There's one over there.
Microphones are, oh, sorry. There's a microphone over here and over here.
So actually, I'm wondering if you might comment quickly on Thomas Molnar in his book, Authority and Its Enemies, sort of echoes your point about how authority arises naturally out of what is, that there's always going to be a need for authority. And so one of the problems with an egalitarian system is that it wants to deny that it has any power at all. And so I was wondering if you might want to comment on that a little bit, because I know that a lot of people in authority right now would be very quick to say, well, I have no power in this situation, and or would run away from it, pretend that there is nothing that can be done, even while lots of things are being done.
Yes, if you wanted to speak I think that's true. We want to hide the fact in modern societies. We want to hide the fact that we're actually brutal in our exercise of power. So it cannot be named. And what I'm trying to do in this talk is to expose what's actually going on. But those in true control, Jeff Bezos, Justin Trudeau, you name them, they have everything at stake with wanting to keep the real power that they exercise hidden. Which raises an interesting question, namely why Justin Trudeau introduced martial law in Canada when there were a few truckers in Ottawa. And honestly, I'm puzzled by it. Because it exposes, and has exposed to many Canadians at least, the exercise of a raw power in the face of just the most minute of opposition to what was going on during COVID. By and large, I would simply underwrite what you're saying. It's the use of power is not being exercised in modern societies at all. Don't get me wrong, right? Absolutely.
I just had a question, just a metaphysical clarification. Could you explain how Dionysius might differentiate between his metaphysic and a pantheist metaphysic?
And
a pantheist metaphysic?
Yes. What a pantheist metaphysic does is it confuses God and creaturely being, identifying the two, whereas and thereby losing any and all sense of transcendence. So for pantheism, there's no transcendence. There's only immanence. In fact, even the word immanence is out of place there. If God and the observable world are one and the same thing. It's interesting that, to me at least, that Christian theologians, especially in the East and in the early church, who borrow from a Christian Platonist metaphysic and thereby emphasize the immanence of God and the participation of creaturely beings in divine being, that those very same theologians are the ones who highlighted divine transcendence more than any theologian since them has attempted to do. The notion of God being hyperousios, beyond being, is an insistence on divine transcendence that many of us, especially in the West, I suspect, would be very uncomfortable with. And the use of negative language, apophatic language, to talk about God is something that generally we in the West are uncomfortable with. The reason is, I think that we Westerners don't actually have as high a notion of divine transcendence as does someone such as Dionysius. So no, it's not pantheist. You could call it panentheism, because God is present in all things and all things are present in God. But we should not forget that in that kind of panentheism, God is radically transcendent. It's not a Hegelian panentheism, in other words. Well, actually, Hegel was a pantheist, not a panentheist, but be that as it may.
Thank you very much. It's 10 o'clock, so we're going to go to our break. And just thank you very much, Father Hans. Thank you.